Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Tuesday morning. I can't believe how fast this year is flying by. Week from today will be the debate between myself and a Dr. Schwartz, about whom I know absolutely positively nothing. Don't like going into a debate like that, but... And, in fact, I just got an email before I came in here that we are going to flip a coin as to who goes first. I'm going to write back and say, if the topic is gay marriage and one side's for it and one side's against it, doesn't the side that is for it go first and then the side that's against it go second? Sort of how I thought it worked, but... that doesn't seem to be how that's, we'll see how that develops. But anyways, that's up in, way up there. I'm looking here at my computer, and I guess I thought I had something here that I had a bunch of stuff all lined up from last week, and of course, it's not there anymore. So, I'd like to start today talking about a debate that I was not at. To talk about a debate that I will be at, and I'm hoping that you will be at as well, and specifically the fact that we have a debate coming up in January of 2009. Haven't talked about it in a while. That is the tendency. You announce it, and then you get busy with other things, and time is marching by, and we have a debate with Bart Ehrman. And most of you, well, many of you would know, if you have RSS readers and things like that, that a debate took place just recently between Dan Wallace and Bart Ehrman. And reading the reviews has been very, very interesting to me. And someone might have the question, well, you know, if Dan did such a great job, you know, why do it twice? Well, they aren't the same debates. That's why. Dan's debate was primarily on the reliability of the New Testament textual tradition and the manuscripts. And our debate is, I think, much more focused, though clearly relevant to the same subject. And that is that Dr. Ehrman has this odd idea. I consider it an odd idea. I'd never really heard anyone enunciate it quite in this way before, that if there is textual variation, then this precludes the inspiration of the text. Evidently, either God could not speak in a written form until computers were invented, or he could only speak in such a context as maybe something written upon a stone, etched in stone, so there could be no textual variation. Obviously, I believe that's a presuppositional assumption on his part, and we'll be addressing that. But the point is that we will be having that debate. I want to look at what Dan Wallace had to say, and then encourage you to be thinking about the fact that debate is right before a cruise that I believe you would really enjoy being on and being a part of. And my understanding is we only have about 2 weeks left on those early bird rates. And so I think we have till the end of April, and that's not a long time. And I just sort of figure... isn't the government supposed to be giving us money back this year? There you go. The government has decreed that you go on the cruise. It's taken away all excuses because, what is it, $600 if you're getting something back? Yeah, well, $600 could get two people going, you know. There you go. No more excuses left. You just have to go with us on a beautiful cruise, four-day cruise. After we have the debate with Bart Ehrman in Fort Lauderdale. And You're going to want to be there because, in case you have forgotten, Bart Ehrman is the person being cited by, well, everybody today. Everybody cites Bart Ehrman. The Muslims cite Bart Ehrman, and the atheists cite Bart Ehrman. I played Christopher Hitchens citing Bart Ehrman. And the irony was, and I'm very, very thankful that he did this, Dan Wallace documented that what Bart Ehrman says in his popular books is not what Bart Ehrman says in his scholarly books. And I think, well, let me just read you what Dan said here. He points out that hopefully next week the audio is going to be available. I guess they don't videotape these things, which to me is crying shame. I mean, you know, this is how people watch things today. They videotape them and they see them. It's not really videotape anymore anyways, but you know what I mean. And but the audio is going to be out, CD, MP3, and then there's going to be a Fortress Press book, which I can guarantee if it's Fortress Press will be about 47 times more expensive than it needs to be. But anyway, at least, hey, I had to buy Fortress Press books when I was in seminary, and it was always just unbelievably expensive. But then I've seen what my daughter's paying for used books today. It's like, then never mind. But he says on his blog, Dan Wallace says on his blog today, my major concern at the conference was to address the confidence that we can have that the manuscripts are generally reliable regarding the essential teaching of the New Testament. This was of utmost importance to me because of how many have read Ehrman's misquoting Jesus. There has been a lot of wholesale skepticism about what the New Testament originally said, an impression that readers both have of his book, and one that has been reinforced many times by interviews with Ehrman on the radio, TV, and in print. The skepticism that he has promoted about the text in his popular writing doesn't match what he has said to professional colleagues. This is a major issue that I pointed out. I was very interested to learn what his real views were. I'm not sure that I did, but one thing I did learn, Ehrman conceded that no essential belief in the New Testament was compromised by the textual variants. That's the main thing I wanted to press for at the Greer Heard Conference. This is an important point that should not be missed. Many Muslims, atheists, and anti-Christian groups have seen Ehrman as a champion for their views. And let me stop right there. When I announced our debate, I mentioned to you a very large book that I have in my library, wherein a Muslim is arguing against the deity of Christ. And yes, he makes liberal use of Bart Ehrman and believes him to be on his side. Many Muslims, atheists, and anti-Christian groups have seen Ehrman as a champion for their views, but regardless of how much doubt he may have about the wording of the original text or how much doubt those who believe they are following his lead have, no one can claim Ehrman is an advocate of an original text that did not speak of the deity of Christ or his bodily resurrection. Boy, is that relevant, for example, to the debates we had this weekend. To be sure, there were several other issues that we disagreed on, and Ehrman was right to raise the question about these important matters. In particular, the interpretation of various passages depends on the variant readings that an exegete adopts. Ehrman thought that I was only concerned about the theological issues, but that is hardly the case. I was most concerned about that issue largely because of how Ehrman's writings have been interpreted by some people and how he made it an issue in misquoting Jesus. Further, it's an issue in which heaven or hell hang the balance, so I do think that it's far more important than mere interpretive issues. Even though, of course, the interpretation of the text is exceedingly important, it pales by comparison with the theological issues at stake. I think the reason that Ehrman did not consider the latter such to be a big issue anymore is because of where he has come, I would imagine, too, in his theological thinking. If there is no heaven or hell, if there is no afterlife, then, of course, the essential Christian beliefs are irrelevant. A good half dozen people came up to me during the conference mentioning that this conference would determine whether they would continue to have confidence in the Bible or not. Some had come from hundreds of miles away, even thousands. All of them said that because of the conference, their confidence that we had today, essentially the Word of God, was bolstered. To be sure, we do not know whether we have recovered the exact wording of the original, and we may never know. At the same time, we are getting closer and closer, and no essential belief is affected by any viable variants, quoting directly from Dan Wallace at this particular point. So the reviews that I've been looking at, reviews are one thing. I'd rather review it myself. In other words, I want to listen before I read a lot of the reviews. I've actually purposefully skipped most of them for that very reason, because if you read a bunch of reviews, then you listen to what you're thinking about. You've already sort of had your mind made up before you ever get there, and you might not really hear what's actually going on. But I am going to be very interested in hearing this because, you know, The only real debate that I've heard airmen in was with William Lane Craig, and that really wasn't on that issue. But I have listened to his presentation that he gave for misquoting Jesus many, many times, and it's pretty much almost always the exact same presentation. There isn't a lot of variation in his presentation, and from what I have seen of some of the summaries that I did read, he pretty much gave the same presentation again. And so it will be very interesting to me to see how there is any variation in his presentation once we get to Fort Lauderdale, because I think that is it's a very related topic. The reliability of the text in the New Testament, very much related, but there is this presupposition that if God has inspired something, then he would not allow any textual variation whatsoever to exist within it. That is something that we need to be looking at. And, of course, that will then start off a period of time where we'll be looking at the truth of God's Word in an unbelieving world. And my goodness, if you're looking for it, man, if you've got almost anything in your RSS feeds these days, if you read newspapers or anything, the unbelief of the world, the willingness of the world to just think in the most anti-Christian of categories, to have a reprobate mind, is all around us every single day. It's hard for me to believe that anyone can question the doctrine of total depravity when we see what is going on in our world today and what people are willing to say and to believe. And so there's going to be a number of great speakers. I don't really count myself amongst them, but I'm going to be amongst those folks as we seek to not only respond to probably the preeminent critic of the trustworthiness of the New Testament, but then to open that word and to encourage you to stand for that word. I surely do believe, and this is indeed my hope and my faith, I surely do believe that it is only the Spirit of God that can encourage his people in having trust and confidence in his word. Now, he does that through means, and I hope and pray that this debate will be part of those means. But at the same time, there is something very encouraging gathering with fellow believers around the topic of the Word of God and hearing others and seeing that you're not alone. So many Christians today are in such a small minority. I can't help but think of my daughter's situation as she fights this battle. She just this past week ended up in a debate in class with a professor on abortion. In fact, I got back to my desk, I picked up my cell phone, and it was a quick request from my daughter for a particular biblical reference, and I had been away from my desk for about 10 minutes, and so I see two messages. One is the request, and then about 5 minutes later, Padre, you know, like, come on, you're my resource here, what's going on, you know, and I know she's in class, so I'm quickly, you know, texting it back, you know. Of course, I can't text nearly at the speed that she can. I think the next generation, maybe we have some evidence of natural selection here, because the next generation, their thumbs clearly move much faster than my generation's thumbs move.
Yeah, they're going to have a whole new development of carpal tunnel thumbs.
Well, it still amazes me. She's using one of my old phones, and I really wish there was some way to go back and to count the number of keystrokes, of how many times the buttons on that particular phone have been pressed. It was definitely not made on a bad day, because it has survived, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of text messages. It's funny. But anyway, how'd I get there? Oh, yes, the anti-Christian attitude of our society is absolutely pervasive, and you can often feel very much alone. Very, very much alone. And so to get together with other believers and to just have that brief period of time can really provide you with a, shall we say, a battery recharge that lasts for a long, long time. And so I hope that you will be considering very carefully the conference, the debate, the cruise that goes afterwards. And like I said, with the government seeking to stimulate the economy, let's stimulate the economy by coming on the cruise in January. And, of course, details are at www.aomin.org. Before we go to our phone calls, I did want to provide some other updates for you. This past weekend was truly amazing. I again, it is my general practice to allow the videotapes and audio tapes of debates to speak for themselves, and I really do believe that that's something we can allow this weekend's debates to do. But I also would say that just simply on a scholarly level, and when I refer to that, I'm not talking about how many degrees you have after your name. I'm talking about doing scholarship, not buying it, actually doing it. And what that means is being able to present an argument that is sound, that is thorough, that is consistent, that takes into consideration the relevant data, that demonstrates you've done some research, some serious research into various points of view, and hence can make claims and recognize and know that the claim you're making in this point is consistent with the scholarship you use to make the claim that you're making in another point. That's called doing scholarship. And the debates this past weekend once again illustrated something that should be very, very troubling to the Muslims who listen to this program, and we know that there are Muslims who listen to this program quite regularly. And that is, once again, I have had demonstrated for me in glowing colors and with incredible clarity the double standards that the defenders and presenters of Islam are willing to embrace when it comes to the inevitable clash, and I do say inevitable clash, between Christianity and Islam. I say it's inevitable because Islam defines itself through a negation of Christian faith. I say it's also inevitable, sadly, because of the mindset of many people in Islam. One thing that came out this weekend was the insistence by my opponent during our debate that Christianity invaded Iraq. Christianity is to be blamed for any of the activities of the American government. This is the same American government, my friends, that, for example, is illustrated by one of the political parties and one of its, at least one of its, I don't even know about the other one, I would assume the same thing, actually both of them now that I think about it, candidates supporting partial birth abortion, which is called infanticide. The very idea that you would identify the American government as an extension of the Christian church, doing the bidding of some, I don't know who, as a Christian entity, is so absurd. It is so ridiculous. It is the moon is made out of cheese ridiculous. It destroys any level of possible rationality on your part. It really does. And yet this is what was being presented by my opponent. And it once again demonstrated to me that I have really not met many Muslims at all that have show any concern for truth. They think they have it, but then they don't demonstrate it by actually being careful enough to want to know accurately what someone else believes. And that's it. It is, of course, no matter, you know, when, as soon as I say that, what happens is people will, for example, comment on my YouTube videos. And if they don't interpret a passage of the Quran the way I do, then they accuse me of doing the same thing my opponent was doing, where he was mistranslating the Bible and ripping it out of context and making stuff up about history, Constantine forcing the Trinity on the church, and all the rest of the silliness. Differing interpretations, I can defend my interpretation of, say, Surah 5 in the Quran. That's not the same thing as deciding that we need to completely mistranslate Surah 5 in the Quran. And once again, it amazes me how many people who profess the Islamic faith just simply refuse to think in an accurate, rational, consistent manner. It's just shocking to me. And I will say this, after the debates this weekend, and the debate 3 weeks ago, almost 4 weeks ago now, in Norfolk, one of my opponents in the Islamic realm continues to look better and better and better as a debate opponent, and that, of course, is Shabir Ali. At least Shabir Ali, when I disagree with him, here's what I'm saying. I don't agree. One of my biggest criticisms of Shabir, of course, is the inconsistency of utilizing left-wing liberal Christian theologians as if that's somehow relevant to me without addressing the presuppositions they're bringing to the text. And so he's not guiltless in this, but oh my goodness, in comparison, as far as hearing the weight of the objection, considering the weight of the objection, trying at least to provide some kind of rational response to it, I'm sorry, so far Shabir's the only one that I've encountered that even makes the attempt. I'm not saying he's successful at it, but at least he makes the attempt, for crying out loud. David Wood debated Jalal Abu al-Rub on, is Muhammad the prophet? And I was a little concerned about that because in the pre-debate stuff, one of the things that had been requested was no blasphemy of the prophet. Well, the problem is, from Islam's perspective, if you do not accept Muhammad as a prophet, you're blaspheming him, period. So just to be a Christian, to show up, to exist, means you're blaspheming the prophet, which, of course, I find utterly irrational as well. And so I was a little concerned about that. And David is an excellent debater. He's very laid back in his presentation. He doesn't talk nearly as fast as I do. He can if he wants to. He can start getting into it. But he generally, is less forceful in his presentation than I am. And certainly less forceful than Sam Shamoon is. And that's just a description of the presentation, not the content. That's just, how he presents it. He can do it in a very kind manner. And so the debate went very well, but it was interesting because Jalal is complaining about even raising the issue of the satanic verses. Well, that's Ibn Ishaq, and we reject that, and you're taking things out of context. And of course, the only thing he really focused upon there, as I recall, was the specific issue of that, and then of course the discussion of Aisha and whether that's right or wrong, and et cetera, et cetera. The standard stuff that you get into in that particular discussion. Of course, David presented a much wider range of discussion than. And as in my debate, Jalal really did not interact with major portions of the actual content of the argumentation that was being presented. But he did strongly rebuke us for daring to say anything about the Quran. David had raised the argument from literary excellence, which is part, it's what the Quran itself argues, which in essence is, my poetry is better than your poetry. And my Quran's better than anything you can write. And I've always found this argument to be just so utterly facile, so utterly without meaning, completely subjective. I mean, I clearly, truly believe that there is Hebrew poetry in Isaiah and the Psalter and so on and so forth that is far beyond anything found in the Quran, but I would never use this as an argument because it's completely subjective. There's no objective standards you can appeal to here. Well, in his response, Jalal is like, how dare you? If you cannot read the Arabic, then you can't even talk about these things. You need to be careful about your sources. You need to look at the languages. You need to be only quoting people who know the languages. You need to check your sources and your background and blah, 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 blah. And, of course, I agree with all that. And I believe that had nothing to do with really providing a meaningful response to David, unless he's trying to say, well, this only works in Arabic. And, of course, David's response was, well, if it only works in Arabic, how can this be an argument for all people when only a small percentage of the world's population is ever going to be able to evaluate the argument anyways? If that's your main argument, that ain't much of an argument. And, of course, he was quite right about that. But then to have him engage my debate where, he's complaining now that I talked about online Internet encyclopedias. What I was referring to was the specific source that he used to garner his John 1:1 stuff is a $9.99 CD you can buy from Amazon. It's available online, and it's old public domain stuff. This isn't meaningful sound scholarship, but he's quoting it and clearly doesn't even know what he's quoting, doesn't understand what he's quoting. He doesn't know the languages, and he would not take responsibility for vetting his sources. As long as the source is out there and it says something about Greek, evidently, it's okay to use. And everybody in the audience, well, I can't say everybody in the audience. Obviously, there were Muslims there that weren't listening to a word I had to say anyways. But at least the vast majority of the audience, I think all the Christians in the audience, were sitting there going, wait a minute. it's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, Dr. Jekyll in the first debate, you got to know Arabic and you got to check your sources. Mr. Hyde in the second debate is going, ah, who cares? Hey, it's your problem. I don't know Greek. What is that? What does it matter? You know? It was just it's absolutely amazing to watch the transformation. And I think he knew it. I think he was struggling a good bit at that point. And you know, the stuff that he came up with the Constantine again, it's just you know, and then of course I loved the, well, you want my sources? I'll post them on my blog in 10 days. Can you imagine the hue and cry that would go up if I ever pulled a stunt like that? If I ever went into a debate with anybody, Roman Catholic, Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, Muslim, it doesn't matter. And I start making statements and I start making claims and the stuff I put in my books even. And then when challenged, go, well, I can't really tell you, you know, but I'll put all this stuff on my blog in 10 days.
Let's just hope this doesn't turn into, you know, 30 days or 60 days.
Oh, like certain Guardian people like Guardian. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Sort of,
I'm saying a comparison there.
That was amazing. And I couldn't help but think of something that Shabir Ali said to Sam Shamoon, because he made the case in their argument, hey, you can't be referring to your website. This is a scholarly argument. You bring it here, and all the Muslims are going, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. You know, so if the Muslim says, hey, don't refer to, you know, give the citations here, Allahu Akbar. If the Muslim says, ah, I'll post in 10 days, Allahu Akbar. You know, that doesn't matter. It's just... Oh, man, I don't they see the double standard? Don't they see? I don't know. It is truly amazing to me. You just go, wow. That's what I've tried to say to people like, you know, Sami Zaitadi. You know, when he posts stuff like he posted about Christianity, showing not the slightest interest in a tiny bit of fairness, a tiny bit of accuracy, that kind of Islam repulses me. Because no truth-loving individual could ever embrace it. You would have to rid yourself of all love of truth to embrace that kind of stuff. You just have to. You just have to erase it from your memory. And, you know, whatever Muhammad says, that's what I believe, and that's all there is to it. And that's a sad, sad thing. But, I don't know when the tapes will be out, but we will, of course, let you know when they are. We are going to take a break and take your phone calls, 877-753-3341. We'll be right back.
Hello, everyone. This is Rich Pierce. In a day and age where the gospel is being twisted into a man-centered self-help program, the need for a no-nonsense presentation of the gospel has never been greater. I am convinced that a great many go to church every Sunday, yet they have never been confronted with their sin. Alpha and Omega Ministries is dedicated to presenting the gospel in a clear and concise manner, making no excuses. Man is sinful and God is holy. That sinful man is in need of a perfect Savior, and Jesus Christ is that perfect Savior. We are to come before the holy God with an empty hand of faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. Alpha and Omega takes that message to every group that we deal with while equipping the body of Christ as well. Support Alpha and Omega Ministries and help us to reach even more with the pure message of God's glorious grace. Thank you.
Public Crimes. The Criminal Mishandling of God's Word may be James White's most provocative book yet. White sets out to examine numerous crimes being committed in pulpits throughout our land every week as he seeks to leave no stone unturned. Based firmly upon the bedrock of Scripture, one crime after another is laid bare for all to see. The pulpit is to be a place where God speaks from His Word. What has happened to this sacred duty in our day? The charges are as follows. Prostitution using the gospel for financial gain. Pandering to pluralism. Cowardice under fire. Felonious eisegesis. Entertainment without a license. And cross-dressing, ignoring God's ordinance regarding the roles of men and women. Is a pulpit crime occurring in your town? Get Pulpit Crimes in the bookstore at AOMN.org.
Back to the dividing line on a Tuesday morning, I think that's what it is. I've been a little busy recently, and I don't get to slow down because even after the gay marriage debate next Tuesday up in San Francisco, which of course means there will be no dividing line next Tuesday, I only have a few weeks before the fire conference in Northern California in May. I thought April was going to be a time for me to get some reading and writing done, and it didn't happen there. So, as I say to any, I see young people come into the channel once in a while and they say, I'm bored. And my response is always the same. I have not been bored since 1978. And, that is actually a true statement. If, James can hold on just one moment, just a couple more minutes, we'll be getting to him. I did want to mention just one other thing in passing. There has been some interesting banter going about on the internet ever since the Steve Gregg debate. And I'm doing my best to try to ignore it or at least not invest much in the way of time in it because I just have too much else to be doing right now. I really need to be starting to focus on the stuff in the fall and all the major projects I need to get done and just really need to let some of this other noise just be noise and do its thing. And but one of the things that struck me as quite interesting is there are people that I call Ponterites. And those who know the history of this know why I call them Ponterites, and those who don't really need to know the history anyways, just take it on my word that I call them Ponterites. And they have a particular hobby horse that they ride, and that's their big thing, and that evidently gives their life meaning, so that's a good thing, I suppose. But I noticed that as soon as the last program aired, and Steve Gregg asked me a particular question. Now, what was interesting was I read last week, one of the Ponderites who went after me immediately on that response that I provided. Immediately. And then another one wrote to me this past week and has posted something. And one of the things that struck me was how quickly they were on this. Some of the language that they've used. For example, I evidently misheard. I certainly have not wasted the time to go back and listen to Steve Gregg's actual question to see whether it was I mishearing or just what it was, but there was an element of the question that I misheard, and in fact, he then repeated it, if you remember that last question. And in looking at the responses, how fast they've been, and then the fact that, for example, one of the Ponderites said it was a very specific and clearly worded question. I'm sort of wondering, where did Steve Gregg get this question? Might it have been suggested to him by people who call themselves Reformed, except they have one primary variation, that is, they're Emeraldians? They seem to be significantly more concerned about that one particular issue than almost anything Steve Gregg had to say, including his inability to see open theism for the heresy that it is and things like that. But that's what Marx Ponderites is, that they're primarily focused upon Calvinists. And I really have to wonder if maybe we have a situation here where there was a desire to use this particular debate just to once again get the debate going on their Emeraldian distinctives. Mainly because, I'll be perfectly honest with you, most people don't listen to what these guys have to say anyways. They're one-trick ponies. They just do this one thing, and eventually people just sort of go, okay, fine, whatever, and move on to other things. And And I think people can tell when folks have an imbalance, where they're constantly harping on one thing. And you can say all sorts of nasty things about me if you want. That seems to be a very popular internet pastime. But the fact of the matter is, I address a wide variety of issues. You know, I mean, look at the debates I've done over the past 10 years. That's a pretty wide variety of stuff, you know, from John Dominic Crossan, John Shelby Spong, gay marriage, all the Islam materials. That's a fairly wide variety of stuff. And I think one of the things that bugs these people so much is that they can't really get anybody to listen to much of what they have to say for a long period of time. And so it just struck me that it's possible, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, I'm not going to waste my time tracking this stuff down, but it just struck me as rather odd that it seemed like this group, as a group, was just sitting there waiting and then pounced on this stuff just to try to stoke the fires and get the stuff going back to, you know, making various and sundry accusations at me and things like that. And so I was very, very thankful, and I should, I don't want this to sound cheesy or anything like that. But, you know, there have been so many times recently, during one of the debates back in Norfolk, I grabbed my BlackBerry, jumped in the channel, said, "Guys, I need this." And there's, not always, but especially during high traffic times, there's almost always somebody in the channel, in our chat channel, who will drop whatever they're doing and has the background and the insight to be able to track down the information that I need. And it's become a real, real resource. And there are some very bright folks that is part of that little family of folks. We sort of almost felt invaded last week by the Steve Gregites, who would come in and try to throw little bombs in to see what kind of quotes they'd come up with. One man came in just to log the channel, just to post the logs elsewhere and stuff like that. And that highly offended me. But there's some really sharp folks in there, and, you know, we have our disagreements with each other, and that's natural, and we're sinners, and so we step on each other's toes and things like that. That's you know, the same thing that happens. I'm not saying that we're perfect or anything like that. But there are folks in there that regularly interact who have different perspectives on things. You know, I think of Cranmer out, the last living Orthodox Anglican. One of those folks is a Turretin fan. His blog is Turretin Fan. That's T-U-R-R-E-T-I-N for those of you who, for some strange reason, don't have the Institute for Linguistic Theology sitting on your desk. Turretinfan.blogspot.com. And he has an article up dated today, Dr. White's more recent debate. And there were some links there I had not even seen of people giving some reports on the debate with Jalal Abu Al-Rub and things like that. But I liked the beginning. It says, "While Pontius' colleagues are raising a tempest about Dr. White's debate with Steve Gregg, Dr. White has recently concluded another debate, this one against a Muslim opponent." And obviously, Turretin Fan and I would debate baptism and a few issues like that, and maybe even some textual perspectives and stuff like that. But there are a lot of folks in the channel, and we can get along because we don't demand that folks be cookie-cutter images of ourselves. And anyone who thinks that I demand that of people just doesn't know me. And half the time when I see people talking about me on the Internet, I wouldn't even recognize me if I didn't see my name there or a bad, distorted picture posted or something like that. But I appreciated the links that were provided there, and the work that he often does. I didn't even realize, for example, the man that I quoted last week was one of the Ponderites until I saw that on his blog. And so I have his blog in my RSS readers and many other people in the channel as well. So I appreciate the fact that there are some folks there who, in essence, have my back, shall we say, and are real resources of information for me as well. So a shout out to all the channel rats and how often they are very, very useful. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. Let's finally get around to talking to James over in Glendale. Hi, James.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
Hey, I was recently talking to a Catholic, kind of an acquaintance of mine, and she mentioned that I guess she goes to a Catholic school, I'm not sure, but she mentioned that one of her professors said that they had gotten rid of, this is her quote, that they had gotten rid of purgatory. And it kind of took me back. So I was wondering, is there any validity to that? I mean, is there some kind of discussion going around about that? I mean, because that was the first I'd ever heard of it.
Well, you know, unfortunately, even Roman Catholics can be exceptionally ignorant of their own theology. And my guess off the top of my head, first of all, I've heard many, many people say that about Vatican II. Vatican II got rid of purgatory, blah, 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 which just is ridiculously untrue. But my guess would be that this particular person might be talking about the recent discussion in papal circles of the doctrine of limbo, which was never really, it's not a dogma, it's not even really a doctrine. And sadly, some people might actually know as little about their faith enough to confuse limbo and purgatory. Then again, come to think of it, how many Protestants could accurately define the difference between limbo and purgatory either? So that might be, if she was thinking of something recently, that would be the only thing I could think of, but the idea that purgatory has been done away with, there's certainly nothing even slightly relevant to that in the actual magisterial statements of the Roman Catholic Church, and that would be next to impossible to do, just simply due to the fact that it is so firmly ensconced. I mean, there's more literal sections on indulgences in the Universal Catholic Catechism than there are on justification. So you would have to get rid of a very wide swath of Catholic theology to get rid of purgatory. Having said all of that, the fact of the matter is, on a functional level, and this is really the crisis of modern Roman Catholicism, on a functional level, in as close to Rome as northern Italy, certainly Europe, as many portions of Europe, secularized Europe, the UK, United States, Western countries, there has been such a secularization of the Roman Catholic clergy and educational system that I would imagine you could find a very large percentage of Roman Catholic priests who, while they, in the presence of their bishop, might affirm the word purgatory, in their pastoral duties, their teaching, and so on and so forth, would so turn it into an allegory and so water it down that on a functional level, the actual doctrine of purgatory would be irrelevant any longer. This certainly is the case in Western Catholicism, where you're hearing more and more people who are willing to say, well, you know, the Church has never defined anything about the nature of the suffering, the Church has never defined anything about the time of the suffering, so it might be instantaneous, and it might just be, you know, boom, you go through this, and that's what perfects you before you enter into the presence of God. And given that so many in the hierarchy of the Roman Church today, especially in education, are functional universalists anyway, everybody's going to get saved, whether you're a Muslim or a Jehovah's Witness or whatever. The whole idea of punishments and sufferings and things like that, just very, very distasteful to them. And so on a functional level, you might very well find a large portion of Western Catholicism that just purgatory no longer has any real meaning to them.
Okay.
So that's the difference between dogma that still exists and cannot be erased from the record of history, and the functional proclamation of the Church in various places in the world. Now, certainly in Mexico, you would find purgatory alive and well, and a fear of purgatory, and you'd have the old time preaching going on there, and indulgences still exist. The Pope continues to give plenary indulgences from Rome. And so it's truly a schizophrenic situation that you're facing when you look at the modern Roman Catholic Church and its teaching.
Okay.
All righty?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, James. God bless. Bye-bye. 877-753-3341. And last program, I said that very quickly, didn't I? Yes, I did. Very, very quickly. On the last program, I started playing one of the phone calls that I was talking about at the top of the hour that I'd queued up Well, on the phone calls from Catholic Answers, James Swan is kind enough to... I don't know why he does this. It evidently is some sort of disorder that he suffers from. But he listens to Catholic Answers live. Yes, I've tried to do the same thing, and I'm just so glad that the Lord has either laid upon this brother's heart or has inflicted this brother with this punishment. One of the two, I'm not sure which it is. So every once in a while, he'll come across these gems and fire them over to me, and so he's doing half my preparation work for the dividing line. And I am so thankful. I didn't. Another thanks here. I imagine this goes out to Micah, who put the Team Apologion graphic back on the blog. Did you do that? No, it was Micah. Micah did that?
No, In fact, I just thanked him for that. I had happened to just notice that today.
Just today? I noticed it over the weekend.
Well, I've been linking directly to the pages, so I don't go to the huge blog
very often.
So.
Just because some of us do appreciate the beauty of the entire website. But anyway, we've got the images back.
I remove this.
<That's>, you know, we haven't heard from for a long time is Angel. I'm really bummed. We have not heard from Angel for a long time. I've got to drop him a line and say, dude, where'd you go? I've had some debates that really, I mean, we need another Ahmed cartoon.
Oh, no.
Don't we? Do we need
we do.
Another Ahmed cartoon? Come on. I mean, my goodness.
That'll be it.
We got to track Angel down again. But anyway, I was so glad to see the graphic back on the blog. And what in the world was I talking about? Talk about skipping directions. I'm sitting there going, blog, blog, blah, blah.
Listening to Catholic Answers. And,
Yes. I'm eventually going to get around to it. Yeah. Yes, but I forget what that had to do with the blog. Oh, that's because James Swan is in the graphic. There was the connection. See how my mind works sometimes? He's in the graphic, and the graphic is back, and that's exciting. Anyway, hey, look. After the past couple weeks, I've had not a day off. You know, it's just like go. I need a day or two off someday. It would be good. So, yeah, Turrets and Fan and Channel just said no Muhammad cartoons. Yeah, can you imagine that one? Isn't it a sad thing that that's funny? It's a sad thing that that's funny. It is funny, and it's because we all know how true it is. I think I stole this from Michelle Malkin, but it's true. It's the religion of perpetual outrage. We are going to walk around, we're going to put a chip on our shoulder and dare you to knock it off. For the sake of the children, stop. Maybe that'll work. It works in California, anyways. Okay, let's get to the Tim Staples call I was talking about before. He had a caller asking about me. I played the first couple bits of this. Let's listen to this call about yours truly from Catholic Answers.
Right here in San Diego, this is Liz. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
So, Tim, I've been looking on the Internet for the last 6 months, and I originally started looking on for debates between you and other, like, Protestant apologists.
Okay.
And I keep seeing this James White guy. And
yes.
Yes. I've come to notice he has a lot of hatred towards the Church, and especially... people that defend the faith, and I know that you've had interaction with him.
Yes.
And I just, what's the story with him, and is this a typical position that evangelicals have towards Catholics?
No, I would not call James White typical.
Thank you.
I would say this, and yes, I have debated him a couple of times formally, as well as a couple of times on Hank Hanegraaff's Bible Answer Man broadcast. Mm-hmm. And I think... James, I have respect for him in as much as he is a Protestant, and he is proud of it, and he lives the word Protestant.
You know, I wonder, does Tim Staples still call me an anti-Catholic? He doesn't in this call. If he has actually made the decision and has heard my pleas and the logic of my pleas that I am what I am, and to define me by him is pretty absurd. I would have to give him kudos for that. He'd be one of the first people to actually, you know, yeah, golf clap. Well, the Masters is this weekend, so golf clap is...
Protest, right? And who are they protesting against? Us.
Yeah.
So in a certain sense, he is of the old school Protestant school. If you look at Martin Luther, John mm-hmm. Calvin, if you look at, you know, the Westminster Confession,
yes.
the Book of Concord, you know, all the way back, and even some of the more recent Protestants, a few hundred years, say Wesley and so forth, you'll find a lot of that. And so in one sense, he is...
Protestants have been historically opposed to the false teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. What a concept! Yes, good. I guess I'm in line with that. Yes.
It's a throwback to the old Protestant, you know, venom toward Catholicism, but I think it's rooted in his deep belief. He is a five-point Calvinist,
yes.
hardcore Calvinist, and he believes that the Catholic Church is teaching things that are contrary mm-hmm. to the faith and leading mm-hmm. people to hell.
Yep.
And that is one of the reasons why he is as passionate as he is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is he typical? No.
Sadly.
He still has a lot of the misconceptions that have been done away with in the modern Protestant Catholic dialogue.
I'd love to get a list of those, but we don't get a list of those.
We've come a long way understanding some of the venom of the past was rooted in things that were misunderstandings. And
that sounds to me like the Council of Trent stuff. You know, Trent was... You're sort of overreacting. I'm not sure how you infallibly overreact, but I have a feeling maybe this is talking about some of the ecumenical dialogues and blah, 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 blah going on there.
In fact, there were some misunderstandings on both sides that have been cleared up over the centuries, but we have a long
infallibly
way to go. And so while I would say he is certainly not typical, there is he is not, you know, a loner either. There is a large number of evangelicals and a larger number of fundamentalists that will absolutely agree with him. And so we need to deal with those issues that they continue to bring up.
All right. Thank you. There's so much, you know, he doesn't seem to have too much love in his heart. And to me, he's really doing a disservice.
Right. Well, you know what, Liz?
Like I said last time, you know, and I can have some fun with this because, you know, people just love to. I mean, when was the last time you heard me sitting behind this microphone and talking about someone I don't know, someone whose works I have not read, someone whose debates I will not listen to, or I will not listen to the full orbed range of their publications or teachings or anything else? Doing the psychoanalysis, you know, Carl Keating going, well, that Carl Keating just doesn't seem to have any love in his heart, you know. It's just, this is, like I said last time, this is postmodernism. This is postmodernism's poster child. Here is the, let's not think about the arguments. Let's not think about the actual stated motivations. Let's just go to the emotions and go to how we feel and so on and so forth. Which, of course, can never lead you to anything beyond your emotions and how you feel.
A lot of people agree with you. In fact, I've talked to many Protestants who will agree with you. But at the same time, I think we should respectfully respond to what is said. I try as an apologist not to respond to people's, you know, emotional states or, you know, venom and whatnot. But simply, let's take the arguments and let's break them down and respond to them. And over the years, Liz, we have seen, as you know, huge numbers of our Protestant brothers and sisters convert. Hundreds and hundreds of pastors.
You know, Yada, it's interesting to compare this with the discussions that you'll find in the news as the Pope is coming today. And the state of the church in the United States and... the grave concern on the part of many of the losses of the Roman Catholic Church to various evangelical denominations. And I really think that, you know, I first started writing this into this back in the late 1980s, you know, this constant drumbeat of the convert, the convert, the convert thing. And, man, I'll tell you, you know, just recently, much to my disgust, Steve Ray was beaten on that drum again, and the level of inaccuracy and simple lies that these folks would put on. I'm not talking about Tim Staples here. I'm just talking about this genre of trying to create an image in people's minds that doesn't really exist, doesn't actually apply to reality, but it helps to keep people happy and to keep people from really considering the major problems that exist in the church. You know, Tim Staples isn't doing that right here, but he is part of it in the convert syndrome. The convert syndrome is if somehow that has something to do with anything. I mean, you know, you hear this from all the time. The Muslims are doing the exact same thing right now as well.
Converting and more coming all the time, many of whom, and myself included, Liz, this is why I have a hard time. You know, I can't condemn James White or Eric Svensson or anybody else because I was worse. You know, I mean, the things that I used to say about the Catholic Church that I know came out of my own mouth. Now, I know it was rooted in ignorance. But I said it nonetheless. I
think we could get an example of this. No, we're not going to get examples of this.
A lot of people would have put me in a category of, man, this guy is long gone. He will never be Catholic, and don't even pray for this guy. Well, thanks be to God.
Somebody did, huh?
Somebody did, because I'm here Catholic. But you know what, Liz, this is the thing. Here at Catholic Answers, we are here not to create heat, but we are here to shed light. And so let's take the issues and let's talk about them.
And I really hope that Tim Staples really believes what he said, because we still keep trying to arrange some debates with Tim, and we haven't been able to do that overly well. Hey, real quickly here, because he has more access to the website than I do, we are going to draw back the curtain and let you see the man behind the curtain with the big voice, who actually just, I've gotten so many compliments on the look of the website, the graphics, the stuff that the stuff we've been putting up for the debates. People say, can I steal that? Can I put that on my website? And so now, I would have a drum roll if I could find a drum roll quickly enough to put it up. The man behind the graphics, Micah. Hi, Micah.
Silence!
Silence! I kill you!
I was going to come on and do it, you know, Haseem the entire time, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Hey, why are you calling the last minute of the program?
Well, it was just interesting to hear this, you know, the discussion about Catholic Answers, and then I was been listening to the radio coming to work today, and they had the Forum program with Michael Krasny. I listened to NPR. anyway, there was they were talking about Pope Benedict coming to the States here, and they had these three people on who one was James Donahue, president and professor of ethics at Theological Union Berkeley, and Monsignor Harry Schlitt, a moderator. The Archdiocese of San Francisco, and they were talking about how women—they were having women priests, and how they were embracing the liberation theology and all of this stuff—and they were hoping that the Pope would be all interested in doing this. And I'm just thinking how it was just—I was just laughing because I was thinking—I was talking with some folks on a forum recently about Sola Scriptura, and they were freaking out about, you know, us Protestants and how we all have 30,000 denominations and all this. And I'm thinking, yeah, it'd be great if we just called all of our denominations one church and just accepted everybody.
Right.
And it seems to me, you know, the authority claims of Rome have no basis when this is what their leadership's saying.
Right.
And anyway, the forum program, you can go to kqed.org and listen to it if you're really interested. But it was pretty interesting to hear them, you know, talk about this.
Yeah, the reality of what the apologists say and what their leaders are saying at the same time are frequently very, very, very different. And if we're aware of it, we will hear it. Hey, thanks a lot, Micah.
You bet.
All right, God bless.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, thanks for listening to the program today. We will be, Lord willing, here on Thursday, but next Tuesday I will be in San Francisco for the debate on gay marriage. And, Lord willing, get back by next Thursday in one piece to give a report on how that goes as well. Pray for us. Thanks a lot. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.